Everybody's oh so happy. Everybody's happy now. Sex galore, but no more marriages. No more pushing baby carriages. No one has to change a nappy. Ain't we lucky? Ain't we happy? Everybody's happy now. Dope for tea and dope for dinner. Fun all night in love and laughter. No remorse, no morning after. Where's the sin and who's the sinner? Everybody's happy now. Girls exotic, girls ecstatic, girls erotic. Hug me, baby, make it snappy. Everybody's oh so happy. Everybody's happy now. If that's all there is, if that's all there is, if that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep dancing. Break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is. Lots to eat and hours for drinking. So my cocktails, no more thinking. No more thinking. Everybody's happy now. There's been a lot of drinking, so shut up! Good night.
And that was the Matthews version of Everybody's Happy Now, the psychopathic poem by Aldous Huxley, and it's time for Gnostic Media's podcast number 225. I'm your host, Jan Ervin. Episode number 225 is an interview with Joe Atwill, part 13, and also Dr. Jerry Russell, titled The Catcher in the Rye, Freemasonry and the Typology of Assassination. This episode is being released on Thursday, March 5, and was recorded today. In this episode, Joe Atwill is back for his 13th time, along with Dr. Jerry Russell, who's back for his second time. I'll spare you their long introductions. In this episode, we discuss Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye and what it really means and why it seems to be tied to assassinations. And for this episode, websites, Joe's website is caesarsmessiahdoc.com and also caesarsmessiah.com. And Jerry and Joe's website together is postflaviana.org, postflaviana.org. And there will be a link to Joe's new article on The Catcher in the Rye up on the Gnostic Media website. And the link for that is postflaviana.org/freemason-rye/. And we'll have the list of Joe's previous episodes so that people can follow through our research on mind control and all of this good type of stuff that we've covered here. And donations. This episode is brought to you by Alan, Will, William, Shane, who made two donations, Oscar, Casey, Paul, who made two donations, Jeremy, Carlos, Roger, Robert, Barry, Scott, Roman, David, and another Robert, and Vinko, Gary, Cameron, Philip, Melanie, David, and Barbara. And of course to 3J98T for your two Bitcoin donations. And thanks to Bjorn again for sending more books for research. Thanks to all of you for getting a donation, and also to those of you who got a membership and helped to support the show. And I should probably mention that this coming week, I have to get a small operation for a lovely inguinal hernia. Oh, joy. So I'll be out for a week or two after that. Got to pay $4,300 cash for that. So anybody who wants to help out, we did raise some to help cover it from last week's show, but we can still use all the donations we can get to help cover the cost of that. And I'm still trying to figure out what to do with the tax situation too. But thanks for all your help. And of course, we do our best to provide just about everything here for free, but your donations and website purchases are what keep us going. And we ask that you sign up for a membership or make a donation, because we can't do it without you. Please also check out the store page, where you can get the 6-year archives, Wheat Blows bumper stickers, bookmarks, books, She Who Remembers archives, DVDs, t-shirts, memberships to download the older podcasts from the first 6 years, etc. The views expressed by the authors and guests are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. Check out the website at GnosticMedia.com, G-N-O-S-T-I-C, Media.com. You can reach me through the web forum on the website or at contact@GnosticMedia.com. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. And here is my interview with Joe and Jerry, The Catcher in the Rye, Freemasonry, and the Typology of Assassination. Enjoy. All right. And Joe, welcome back to the Gnostic Media Podcast for your 13th time. And Dr. Jerry Russell, welcome back for your second time.
Hello.
Hello.
Good to be here.
And so let's see. What we're going to be talking about today is The Catcher in the Rye, Freemasonry, and the Typology of Assassination. So who would like to kick off? Joe?
Sure. There's a new article out, and it's on the postflaviana.org website. I have sent it to you, Jan. I wrote it and then worked with Jerry basically to edit it. And also, Jerry made a few critical improvements on my analysis. The general analysis is fairly simple to understand. You have the surface narrative of the story of The Catcher in the Rye, which most people know about. It's this neurotic young man, 17. He drops out of his prep school, goes to New York, has a series of kind of strange experiences, and then apparently has a kind of mental breakdown at the end of the story. And there's a conclusion where he's, after the fact, saying that he's going to try to get out of evidently some institution and try to do better at school. So that's the surface narrative. But I discovered that there was actually a typologically created storyline that was underneath the surface, which basically was recounting the process by which Salinger's character, Holden Caulfield, goes through the levels to become a master Freemason. So in the book, there's a statement by Caulfield that there was a secret society that he was too yellow not to join at his prep school. And this is really the starting point of this subtext.
Yeah, I feel like
which
that's
is
really
the identity of the secret society, secret fraternity that he joined.
Yeah, that's really a clear invitation to try to figure out what that secret society is.
Right.
Shouldn't really be controversial that there's an answer to that riddle.
No, it isn't. And, you know, that's funny, isn't it, that that's often the case, that the oligarchs have this language of typology. It's in the Gospels, it's in Shakespeare, and it's in a lot of the modern literature. And basically, it is right in our face. It isn't that hard to understand once you realize that people are using it to document their triumphs and their goals. And so when Caulfield says that he's joining a secret fraternity, the reader should attempt to have some opinion about that. Well, what secret fraternity is he talking about?
Joe, would you suggest that Freemasonry may be carrying on at the highest levels of the training of this typology, or where do you think it might be coming from?
It has to be existing. Yeah, for sure it is. And in the book, you can see that there are these different levels of Freemasonry that Caulfield is walking through. He's processing through these different levels. And some of the levels involve learning about the secret nature of the organization. The kind of Freemasonry that Caulfield eventually becomes a member of isn't this beneficial form that has hospitals and does charity work, but it has a very sinister agenda. And to reach these higher levels, you have to be aware of what the organization is doing, and therefore you have to know about its language. You know, we talked about the Beatles and Sergeant Pepper and all of the Freemasons on the cover of Sergeant Pepper. And I would suggest that what we're looking at with Holden Caulfield is basically another representation of that, that this is on one level is just a way to express their power, their genius. It's a way of creating documentation about what they're doing. So, you know, with Sergeant Pepper and I Am the Walrus, you have, this obvious typology that they're engaging in. And this is just another example of it. Sure, they must know all J.D. Salinger, who was in military intelligence, incidentally. He was, in Europe, purportedly was, one of the first people to go into the concentration camps. There are a lot of rumors about how much or people he knew and the stuff he was involved with as a member of the OSS. But
let me ask you, Joe, do you know which camps he would have gone into first? Was he going into Buchenwald, for instance, with C.D. Jackson and Billy Wilder, et cetera?
No, I don't know the camps he went into. I think it's actually documented somewhere. I just don't have it in my mind. I do recall him saying that he could smell burning flesh. He actually made that comment, which is strange. And after the war, he comes back and publishes this book. And the book is cryptic, even on its symbolic level. In other words, when you read the article, people will see that it's a very aggressive and kind of comic deepest secret of Freemasonry that Salinger reveals. And I'm going to use an obscenity, so just be aware of this.
Why don't we go into those two songs or poems before you give the title away?
Oh, okay. Well, the Catcher in the Rye is a misunderstanding of a song that Robert Burns wrote. And Robert Burns basically was just picked up on a kind of a limerick that existed in Scotland. And then he wrote the version that we know, which is Coming Through the Rye. In the story, Caulfield misunderstands the child who is singing the song, and he thinks he says catcher in the rye, and instead of the version of coming through the rye, you know, which would be basically, can a body meet a body coming through the rye? Can a body kiss a body, need a body cry? And so that's the...
Just go ahead and read the rest of it, or I will here, so you don't have to be shy about it. Gin a body, meet a body, coming through the rye, the glen, Jenna body, fuck a body. Need the world can. Jenna body, meet a body. Coming through the grain. Jenna body, fuck a body. Cunts a body. Ain. Jenna
right.
body.
So in other words, there's, you know, a body, another, yeah, there's a body version and then there's a cleaned up version. And the body version, he uses the, you know, can a body fuck a body?
Right.
So it's really the song is about basically having sex.
And so then the real title would be of Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, I mean, if the actual sort of understanding that a reader has when he goes through it is that it isn't Catcher in the Rye, it's, you know, the F word in the rye and our fucker in the rye. And that actually describes the kind of mean and aggressive spirit that is being promoted by the Freemasons. And this is completely clear because when you recognize that it is a typology describing this Freemason initiation, you come to the point where he would be able to enter the Holy of Holies, which Salinger sets up as a place in the museum that has the ancient Egyptians, and the Egyptians and the ancient religion as being one of the Freemasons' basis for, you know, their origin of their organization. And so when Caulfield goes in there, he's actually representing, or Salinger's representing, that he's going into the Holy of Holies, which is a room that is in the Freemason Lodge, which of course is based upon Solomon's Temple. And in Solomon's Temple, you have the Holy of Holies. And so this is replicated in the Freemason's Lodge. And Salinger's playing off of this by having Caulfield go into this museum. And in there, he goes into a room where there are the ancient Egyptians. And these brothers take him there, and then he goes in by himself. And when he comes in, he sees this deep secret, which is simply the word "fuck you." That's what is given as this deep secret, and it's cryptic. I mean, you can have different interpretations. I think even Jerry and I would have a different understanding of what it means, but it is clearly an aggressive and hidden agenda. And so when you look at the book in that light, what you really end up with is, as I see the book, is you come to the end of the book where Caulfield is at a merry-go-round that have these horses on it. And basically, Salinger is representing the apocalypse that's described in the book of Revelation. It's just a way of, you know, kind of symbolically representing this as the goal, which would be to the Freemasons, fuck you, that, you know, we're taking the book of Revelation and bringing about the conclusion that is described there. And this is would be an FU to basically to the Roman Catholics and Christianity in general, in terms of how I think they would see the book of Revelation. So that's the basic lineup. And, you know, when you'll see that when you go through the article that there's some very clear symbolism. There's some of the symbolism takes a bit of sort of understanding, and one can argue one way or another. But a lot of the things that we show in the article is, in fact, straightforward. And any reader will say, oh, yeah, there is this secret side to Catcher in the Rye that hasn't been noticed before. And it is basically that Holden Caulfield, when he fails at his prep school, it is really representing his failure to pass the exams and become this different levels of the Freemasons. And then when he meets different individuals, Luce meaning light, and Antolini meaning different line. These are individuals who simply help him get through the different levels. And then his sister named Phoebe meaning prophetess, she makes what amounts to a prediction concerning the this conclusion of the book of Revelation with this cryptic writing, which is a little hard. That part is a little hard to understand, but I think most readers would you know, accept the analysis as coherent. So anyway, it's quite an interesting discovery, and it's going to be interesting to see just how culture responds to this. What do you think, Jerry?
Well, first problem is to get culture aware of what you've found, of course. I do feel like the case is persuasive. You know, if you run down the list of symbols that you've discovered, the first would be that there's a 28-day period during which Caulfield is said to be studying the Egyptians. So 28 days turns out to be the period of time in Freemasonry from when you first sign up to when you take the first exam, and from when you become an admitted novice to when you take the second degree exam. And Egyptians, of course, is a very good metaphor for the Freemasonry, because they consider themselves harking back to that time. And in the exam, it's said that Holden Caulfield is only really interested in how the Egyptians were buried, and so he wants to skip all the details. He just wants to get to the meat. And when you go to the end of the book, Caulfield gains entry to the temple, and there are the coffins of the Egyptians. So there's some foreshadowing there that what Caulfield is interested in the beginning is what he finds at the end. So that's the first interesting clue, the 28 days. The next theme that gets developed that is distinctly related to Freemasonry is sleeping in Eli's bed. Now, that is a Freemason ritual that's called the Introduction to the Prophetical Office. And it's repeated three times that Caulfield is sleeping in Eli's bed.
And right. I thought that was very clear symbolism. I think most people will simply accept that there is a subtext to the book concerning a Freemason initiation once they see the 28 days studying the Egyptians followed by sleeping in Eli's bed. I don't think anyone's ever noticed those concepts are from Freemason initiation before, and I just think that they're so unique and obvious in the book. They're so unique to Freemasonry and so obviously represented in the book that I think I just feel that most people will simply accept that this is the correct way to understand the symbolism.
Right. Now, the next one that's very lucid is reenacting the death of Hiram Abiff. And there's a scene where Holden Caulfield is shaken down by his friend Ackley. And it's an exact replica of the rite in the Freemason temple.
Yep. And so you can see that basically the whole book is structured where these events seem as though they're existential, but are, you know, it's not clear what exactly Caulfield is up to. But in fact, he's just talking about this initiation process that Caulfield's going through.
Right. Now, the next very lucid connection to Freemasonry is Albert Pike thinks he's hot stuff. You know, Albert Pike being the very famous American Freemason, and he appears as a character in the book as a person who is very conceited and a show-off. And the next lucid connection is that, again, Caulfield seeks light, which is what Freemasons do, is seeking light. He goes to a fellow named Carl Luce and gets all kinds of insights about patterns in the mind and psychoanalysis.
Right.
I think that's about it for the direct connections to Freemasonry.
Well, and then the temple. Then you have Antolini with the different line. The name means different line. He goes to Carl Luce. Luce means light. And then after that, he goes and sees another individual named Mr. Antolini. And Antolini actually, tells him, he gives him this piece of paper and he hands it to him. Again, it's another aspect of the Freemason initiation rituals. And on it is written that it's better to live humbly for a cause than to die nobly for one. I'm paraphrasing it, but that's what he means. And so you can see that the idea of living humbly for a cause, this is, of course, a way of representing, you know, you've got to not openly discuss the cause that you're involved with, living humbly for a cause. And then Caulfield goes to sleep, he basically is naked, which I, again, is a representation of the, one of the initiation themes, and wakes up to find Antolini patting him on the head. And this, you know, is another thing that, that can be seen as part of the initiation. And now,
is patting on the head a ritual? Do we know
that? Yeah, tapping on the head, but, you know, one of the problems with the Freemasonry initiations is that they are secret. There are a lot of people that have written about them, so if you do internet, you do research on the internet, you can find out what the forms of the things are of in some cases. But, you know, sometimes you have to basically fill in the blanks. There are certain initiations that I have found where that involve this tapping on the head. It represents blows to the head, like being knocked out. Caulfield talks about feeling dead all the time, and they represent the death of Hiram Abiff in strange ways. And it's when Caulfield goes to Antolini, he is basically receiving the information that he needs to become a master mason, this high level of Freemasonry, which evidently allows him to know the truth and of their deepest secret, of their real purpose. The museum is representing the Freemason Lodge in the book, and before he meets Antolini, he comes to the museum, and for some reason he can't go in. He just cannot force himself to go in, and this is simply because he hasn't the high enough level to be able to go into the Holy of. After he meets with Antolini, he is then able to move forward, and he goes into the he can now enter the museum. He goes in. He's met by two people that are called brothers. And this, of course, is one of the designations of the Freemasons. They refer to themselves as brothers. And now he can go to the Holy of Holies. They take him there. And lo and behold, he finds the deepest secret is fuck you. And then he also says that he realizes now that no matter where he goes, he's going to see the word everywhere. In fact, it's even going to be on his grave, which is just indicating that it's an oath taken to the death, basically.
Now, this is where, by the way, that Joe and I have a different interpretation, because the thing that I see is that even as Caulfield is going through these initiation processes, and even as he's learning more and more about Freemasonry, he's at the same time disgusted with it, and he's thinking about quitting. He wants to move to Colorado, and he wants to get a job as a ranch hand. So he really is desperate to get out of this mess. And Antolini gives him a death threat. He says, look, I see you falling to a horrible young death here. You really need to change your way of thinking. And as he's going out with that thought in mind, I think that's when he sees these fuck you messages as a message of doom to himself to not quit the fraternity. And eventually he decides, well, I'm not going to quit the fraternity. I'm just going to be happy. I'm going to go and I'm going to join the establishment. I'm going to go to this rehabilitation camp. I'm going to meet up with my dad and make peace with him. So I think the fuck you is a message that says don't quit the order, stay with it. And I think it's very possible that whatever the deepest secret is, we still don't know it or is not revealed in the book. It's not obvious to me that the fuck you is the deepest message.
Right, it's possible, but I would just say that the, you know, the key kind of symbol that gives you the most solid way to understand it is Caulfield at the beginning of the book talks about having a shooting hat, and it's a hat that is a hunter's hat, and this friend of his who's involved in the initiation says, what kind of a hat is that? And Caulfield says, this is a shooting hat, and it's a special kind of one. It's a hat that you wear when you shoot people. And he closes one eye, makes the one eye representation of, you know, that Freemasons have of this the single eye of God. And so it's a hat that you wear when you shoot people. And after he has the initiation, this, or when he finds the deep meaning, he is he's given the hat to his sister Phoebe, who then gives it to him. Now she gives it to him and says, "You can wear it for a while." And so Caulfield, at the conclusion, wearing his hat that he shoots people with at this, the final scene, which I think is clearly representing the apocalypse. And then beyond that, the whole the business with the catcher in the rye, because before he has the final scene where he's at the merry-go-round and the kids are spinning around on horses and he's wearing the hat that he wears when he shoots people, he talks to his sister and he says, "You know, I heard a child singing the Robert Burns song, and I want to be that individual." And it's sort of like Jerry was saying that Caulfield has a hard time accepting the kind of hard behavior that I think is required at these levels. And Caulfield says he wants to catch children when he falls. That's why the title of the book is called Catcher in the Rye. It's referring to Caulfield's position of, like, he wants to live for the benefit of non-Masons. He wants to be more non-violent and help people, you know, away from danger. He wants to catch kids as they fall off a cliff. He says, "That's what I really wanted to be, was the catcher in the rye." And his sister says, no, you've totally misunderstood the song. That's not the song at all." And that is the, she talks about another version of the song as possible. Now, immediately before Caulfield puts his sister on the merry-go-round, he says, "You know, I know that the truth is that you really, when kids try to go for the gold ring, you can't help them. You just have to let them fall. They should, if they fall, they fall." So this, I think, is a clear symbolic track of what the fuck you means. The fuck you is related to the song, which is at first beneficial. Caulfield says he wants to help people, and then after he gets the information after he accepts being the higher level and gets the what I got regard as the deepest secret, he now says, "Okay, just let him fall," and this would be accepting the level of the song that is basically vulgar and has the fuck word in it.
Yeah, well, I think there's just a slight distinction that you can make between the shooting hat and between the fuck you, because the shooting hat is what Caulfield wears at the end, and there's this song that's playing, "Smoke Gets in Your Eyes."
Right.
And you're kind of left wondering, well, is this really kind of the dreamlike scenario that's actually told in the book, where he's just dancing around in the rain and being very happy at seeing his sister riding the horse and seeing all the kids reaching for the gold ring? Or is this really some sort of nightmare scenario, like one of these mass shooting things that you see in the news from time to time?
Right. Well,
maybe he really killed all the kids and then couldn't bring himself to admit it in his own self-autobiography there. And maybe that's why they sent him to rehabilitation, because
right,
he shot up all the
kids. Right, that's actually possible, yeah. Yeah, I think that the best way to understand the smoke getting in the eyes is from the earlier use of smoke in the eyes, where he meets with these two Catholic nuns. Holden Caulfield meets two Catholic nuns, and he talks in a symbolic way about their religion being false, about it being imitation. And then at the end, he's smoking a cigarette, and he says, "I blew smoke right into their face." And he goes, "I don't know why I did it. It was rude. I apologize, but I did it. I just blew smoke right in their face." And I think that's sort of the kind of helping us to see where he's going with this. It's Catholicism that is actually, our Roman Christianity, that's really being assaulted here, because at the very beginning, Caulfield has this one scene where he's learning one of the levels where he talks about shooting the bull. And he's going to be shooting the bull. And you don't really know what the bull is, except if you read the passage, you'll see that he seems to be talking about Taurus representing Christianity, the bull. And in the way he's cryptically writing about it, he just means that Christianity is bullshit, that it's fake, imitation. And so when you have the scene where Salinger is talking to the Catholic nuns and he's clearly indicating that their religion is an imitation, he uses the analogy of luggage and imitation luggage and real luggage, Mark Cross leather luggage, as opposed to fake imitation luggage that the nuns had. And so he blows smoke in their face, and I think this is typology. It's just prefiguring what's going to happen at the end, where he's going to be, smoke will get in the eye of the Taurus, the Christians, when he basically blows smoke in their eyes when he shoots the bull, when he gets rid of it. Now, the question is like, to what extent, even if, you start to accept the harder version of the interpretation, the one I suggest, is what is Salinger really saying in the final scene? Is he just saying that the images that he's seeing, in other words, there's a song playing called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, there is the horses being represented, Caulfield now has the understanding, is it just his awareness of the coming apocalypse that now has, gotten Holden Caulfield to... he now says he's very happy. He's happier than he's ever been. He's feeling good and everything. Or is it something worse? I given an example from another Freemason who concluded another work, Tom Sawyer, with the same basically with the same symbolism and the same. The same message. We want to get into what the message is and to why all these assassinations. But I just wanted to read Twain's ending of Tom Sawyer because it's real short and people can kind of get a sense of the what actually is going on here. And it's at the conclusion of Tom Sawyer, they're talking and it says, when are we going to start the gang and turn robbers? Robbers, right? Oh, right off. We'll get the boys together and have the initiation tonight. Have the witch have the initiation. What's that? It's to swear by one another and never tell the gang secrets, even if you're chopped all to flinders, and kill anybody and all his family that hurts one of the gang. Okay, so this is the conclusion of Tom Sawyer from the Freemason Mark Twain, and I won't go into Tom Sawyer, but it's another... kind of representation of in many ways, of Freemasonry. It's not as dense as Salinger, but he's definitely in the same genre. And here you can really see, that this level, the gang secret, when you get to the initiation, is pretty violent. Kill anybody and all his family that hurts one of the gang. Never tell the gang secrets. This is just exactly what the ending in my mind that exists for Catcher in the Rye. And it's exactly why the book has been associated with assassinations. The book is not an attempt to mind control individuals as a signal.
It's not a trigger book.
I mean, that's absurd. It is a symbol of, it's a message.
Joe, let me ask you, Joe, have you researched who originally started the trigger book nonsense?
Well, I know there was John Marks, the Manchurian Candidate.
The Search for the Manchurian Candidate.
I saw the movie.
The Search for the Manchurian Candidate, you mean, is John D. Marks.
Yes, yes.
And so is he the first one that suggested that you've seen? Or
that's the first one that I've seen. What about you, Jerry? Is there any earlier, like this idea of the trigger?
Well, I haven't researched it. It's not obviously nonsense to me because there is this phenomena of hypnosis and of hypnotic phrases, but you would never know what the phrase was because it would be something that was implanted in the victim, so to speak.
Well, sure, that's true. But, you know, like, who's the one that shot, you know, Sirhan that shot Bobby Kennedy? He had seen a woman wearing a red polka dot dress. But I'm glad that you brought up John D. Marks, because he is the director for the Bureau of Intelligence and Research. So he is, in fact, an agent.
Yeah, well, wasn't he? I seem to recall that he was involved with MK Ultra, though.
Well, yeah. You know, in fact, I've been working on a new article that entirely exposes him. But in 1979, he and Wasson and Carl Ruck and Albert Hoffman and the whole crew, they basically got together and helped him with his book, The Search for the Manchurian Candidate, which is different than the book, The Manchurian Candidate, that became the movie. That one was a novel. But, you know, John D. Marks, he's the one that essentially created the whole nonsense story about, you know, Dr. James Moore being the mole that infiltrated Wasson's thing into Oaxaca, Mexico. But a lot of the, you know, and it appears that even Bicycle Day may have come from John Marks's rubbish.
Well, you know, I do agree with Jerry that the auto-suggestion and kind of deep control has been a focus of study. I don't have any idea to what extent they've succeeded. I certainly have a hard time believing they can trigger specific behavior with visual images, but who knows?
Yeah, I don't think it's a very likely way, because how would you control at what moment they to read it?
Well, if you, you know, yeah, you know, if you study Darren Brown, the magician out of England, he's recreated the Sirhan assassination of Bobby Kennedy on his show, and showed how it could be done in a controlled environment. But, you know, getting David Chapman to read the book at a specific time or whatever, that would be a little bit trickier.
Yeah, I think the main interest about the book is the fact that it's had such a influence on culture and been spread all over high schools and colleges and read by millions of people. Why is that?
Well, you know, and I've sent to Joe a list of books that are required reading in high schools, et cetera, and there's like 80 or 90 books, and almost all of them are, you know, associated with the Huxley George Orwell clan, etc. So, you know, there's this whole little group of them, but, you know, we've got, you know, George Orwell in there with Huxley, of course, Mark Twain that Joe just mentioned, you know, and Frank, you know, yeah, and all of these people, Elie Wiesel, I think that's the same one that teaches at Boston University. He's been proved a fraud too. So anyway.
Right, and then you have throw in a little Shakespeare, and you've got the whole Western civilization. So the interesting thing about Catcher is it has the potential, because of the clarity of some of the episodes, not all of them, but some of the episodes are so clearly representing Freemason initiation. In my opinion, it has the potential to start a general response by culture, by the population, by the citizen, where they would start to say, you know, we need to really look a little more closely into these books that have been influencing us to see really what the symbolic framework of the books are. I think that the list that you mentioned is obviously a deliberate one, and it looks to me as though, particularly when you think about books like 1984, Brave New World, the Shakespearean literature, Catcher in the Rye. I mean, you're really, this is a large fraction of all of the books that kids who go through high school have to read. Why is that? And when you start to look at, my point is just when you start to look at Catcher and you see this pretty clear-cut symbolism that hasn't been brought to light before, the hope is that it'll just create some energy in the part of the citizens to start doing some work in this area and becoming more familiar with the material that they're being force-fed.
You know, what I'll do for this episode is I PDF'd that list, so I'll post the list of all of those books to the show notes.
Yeah,
so, Joe, I think it's a really interesting point that, you know, millions of people have read this, and they see the surface message that, that Holden Caulfield is just having a tough time in life and drifting and all of his various miscellaneous observations. And the thing's kind of has a dumbed-down feel to it. It feels like restricted vocabulary, like it's been written to a grade level.
Yeah.
So people read this thing and maybe derive from it kind of a disrespect of culture and maybe a feeling of easygoingness themselves, a feeling of why should I put myself out in school because Holden Caulfield didn't and look what happened to him, and kind of feeds into that drug culture that you've been talking about in a way, the devil may care culture. So they see that, and this may be the first time that anybody has ever seen what you saw. And yet they certainly are clear once you see them. And it
right.
leaves,
and then
it leaves
the other
this
aspects,
feeling.
I think, take on a different light, because if you look at the book in terms of its timing, it really was part of what brings about the Beat Generation, which then eventually becomes the hippies and ultimately leads to Woodstock.
And that was Allen Ginsberg and the whole Greenwich Village team who were a part of MKUltra, William Burroughs, Joyce Glassman, who's Daniel Pinchbeck's mother, et cetera. That was the whole, the CIA's whole Greenwich Village team. And then they actually migrated over to Boulder, Colorado later on to work with the Naropa Institute there that I exposed with Professor Jay Fikes on a show a few weeks ago.
Interesting.
And you've got to wonder when these Freemasons get to the inner level of the temple and start to take these 33-degree lessons, you got to wonder if part of the secret is to read these various books the way you read them. You know, and learn.
Yeah,
learn
that is kind of an interesting thing. In the book, we show that in the article, we show that there are scenes where they talk about a type language, and they use it directly related to Jesus Christ. They set up the symbolism of Jesus, and then the character who's Bernice or Bernice, which is obviously who's called a queen, and therefore you're connecting right into the family of Herod and the Flavians and the origins of Christianity. And she is upset because Holden Caulfield is using the type language. Don't use that type language. And that, I think, is pretty straightforward, cryptic, a little cryptic, symbolic way of talking about the typology. And that's the point Jerry made, something I've wondered for a long time, is what disclosures about our literature do they make to these individuals as they bring them up through the levels? I mean, clearly they're going to explain the Gospels to them. They're going to probably explain Shakespeare. I noticed that in Sergeant Pepper's, you've got the line, the one and only Billy Shears, which is a cryptic representation of William Shakespeare. And this is clearly the case because the next line that is sung is, "Lend me your ear, I'll sing you a song." Ringo chimes in, and that, of course, "Lend me an ear" is a quotation from a Shakespearean play, Julius Caesar. And so you understand that they're cryptically representing Shakespeare. And then, of course, on the cover of Sergeant Pepper, my God, about half the people on it are known Freemasons, and a lot of individuals are, you know, suspected. So it's, you know, obviously there is some Freemason influence inside Sergeant Pepper, which would, add to this mystery that you see when you start to understand Catcher in the Rye, and, for example, Mark Twain, Tom Sawyer.
Yeah, how likely is it that J.D. Salinger buried all these Easter eggs in this novel so that you could discover them 60 or 70 years later, Joe?
Right.
Doesn't make sense.
Makes no sense, yeah. So it is a planned representation. There has to be an organization. And I'm not in complete disagreement with Jerry's the interpretation he gave, that Salinger is representing his struggle, that he can be taking the FU as directed against him. But I also think that it's, no matter how we cut it, the FU is from the organization, and it's to its members, and I think clearly to the world. And it's
I don't question that at all.
Yeah, and so I think that that's kind of how I see it as at the very least, it's suggesting that the organization has a pretty tough, a kind of aggressive agenda at its higher levels that is kept secret. That I think is kind of my takeaway. What would you say, Jerry? Is that something we can agree on?
Well, you know, in that connection, you puzzle about the relationship between the Freemasons and other groups like the CIA and the military. Clearly, the military has this very aggressive attitude. And you have the situation that J.D. Salinger was not only affiliated, apparently, with the Freemasons, but he was also affiliated with military intelligence. And so...
Right.
The Freemasons may be sort of the speculative, philosophical recruitment arm of all of this.
Right, and how it plugs into the other organizations, I think, is something that people need to determine, but you can't really find out about that from just trying to decode the symbolism. I will note that I've read that every British general in World War I was a Freemason. So... this is, it's a mystery that has to have some explanation. I think citizens.
Yeah, and I sort of wonder if the Freemasons at some point blew their cover. I mean, at this point, you can now read about their initiation rituals. And I don't know about your community, but here in our town, the Freemasons are pretty well on the downtrend. I mean, our Unitarian Church bought their building, and we talked about the ghosts that were coming out of the building from the old Freemasons. It was a wreck of a building, and they apparently moved to a much smaller place. And there's said to be five or six of them in town.
Interesting. I know that Freemasonry has been described as an outer circle protecting an inner secret. That was someone who had done a lot of research into it, and he said that the way it was representing itself to the public and the lower levels that they would bring people into the organization and get them to certain points, that all of that was basically a cover for this inner secret that the organization held.
Well, Joe, I wonder if that has anything to do with B'nai B'rith. I do have some videos under Freemasonry in the database that expose them as committing much of the murders regarding, or them being in charge of the murders of 60 million in Russia.
I really don't have any idea. I think that what the steps that I would hope would be taken would be to have the population recognize that there is an organization that is affecting our lives, and that it is not influenced by democracy, and it has a dangerous genocidal agenda, in my opinion. And so that would be the first step, is just to create the awareness that the organization exists. And then from there, to try to parse out all of the different tentacles and points and different clubs and things. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if what we call the organization would actually abandoned different entities after it made use of them for a while, just because it provides a perfect cover to leave them for someone else to deal with. The thing that we need to do, and I've said this, as you know, many, many times, we need to get a genetic understanding of the oligarchs and of the inner circle. And I mean, basically, Skull and Bones, Bohemian Grove, Council of Foreign Relations, CIA. I mean, these organizations, and particularly at the controlling levels, the generals in the army, we need to have democracy get to a higher quality. We need to know exactly who we're voting for and who is ordering whom to do what. Because I am very worried that we will find a family and an ethnicity that is involved with all of this destruction. Because in my opinion, to keep secrets, as long as they have to have some power in order to do that. And I would think that, you know, ethnicity and family, and again, the family may be something that includes many ethnicities at this point. Who knows where that what they've actually done? We just don't have an idea. I just know that I'd really like to get an understanding about the Bush family, the Rockefellers, the Cheneys, and the Rothschilds. If we could possibly have some DNA from those guys so we could look at it and see if there's family relations, because if there is, then we would know exactly what we're dealing with. And it would be a completely different response by the citizen in order trying to create the higher level democracy.
Interesting. Jerry, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Well, I think the ethnicity might be interesting, but just the idea that there's this group is really the key to it. And we need to elect some people and bring some people into power who are clearly outsiders from that. Maybe some people selected at random even, or just some ordinary people.
Right. One thing I would say is that obviously the political structure that we're dealing with is compromised. Because the media is such a controlled element, it's almost impossible for us to know who we can trust as far as candidates that they're bringing to us. I mean, Barack Obama.
I was just going to say, Joe, that, after doing a lot of recent research, I decided to kind of rename the CIA the Central Entertainment Agency, because they're so wrapped up in all levels of entertainment and what information the public gets, whether it's movies, television, plays and screen rights, books, you name it, they're involved in all of it.
Sure. Well, look at Walt Disney. I mean, he belonged to what's referred to as Uplifting Lucifer. It was a social club that Frank Bond and H.R. Haldeman's father belonged to. Haldeman's father actually started the club in Chicago and brought it to the West Coast. And then you have Disneyland with Lewis Carroll, who we know basically, with his poem, The Walrus and the Carpenter, is a Freemason.
Isn't it like all of Aldous Huxley's and Wasson's and their little clique of friends involved in the whole psychedelic thing suddenly showed up in Orange County or Anaheim under the theme of Disneyland?
Yeah, but I'm just saying that if you look at like who Disney represents, if you look at Tom Sawyer, I mean, that's a huge part of the Disney storyline. Lewis Carroll, the Mad Hatter, that's just everywhere. Pinocchio, written by a Freemason. I mean, it seems to me that, and then of course Disneyland has this weird 33 club,
sure,
right in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's and I've been past that doorway before,
which obviously is representing this high level of Freemasonry. So and then of course the animal humor that you see in Shakespeare, where people are represented as pigs, and Woodstock, where the hog farm is where the bad-tripped hippies are taken. With Disneyland, you have this beginning of that kind of idea with the Mouseketeers, where the children are characterized as mice or rats. And, I mean, it seems so harmless on its surface, but if you look at it at the teenage allowances level, I'm referring to that line on the cover of the Life magazine cover story of the MK Ultra project, sub-project 58, then it doesn't seem so benign. It doesn't seem so innocent. It's worrisome. It's troubling. Seems like it's part of a pattern, particularly when you look at Disney's connections into all of these things and the people that he represents. Now, it's quite possible that, the whole thing is innocent and that it's just an influence that comes his way from a bad source. Again, these are things that the citizen just can't know at this point. I'm hoping with this article, with things like the decoding of I Am the Walrus, and with the general line of reasoning and analysis that we're trying to do with the website postflaviana.org, that we will just be part of what is creating a better democracy. I mean, if you think about the JFK assassination, the citizens were completely defenseless. We were going to believe whatever the media told us because we didn't have any way of developing our own analysis and then sharing it. But now with the internet, this is totally different. And that's why your site is so revolutionary, and the things that we're trying to do at Postflaviana are so important, is because we have now a tool, the internet, where we can develop our own analysis and then we can share the information. And so I would hope that things like the brain database that that you created, the you know, the stories, that articles that you post, that people who are influenced by them will take the next step and try to help connect those, that information to more people. What we really need to do is develop our own media. We need to have our own media so that we can conduct analysis in an open way without being there being kind of a governmental wall. For example, the reports on the 9/11 bombing destruction, you know, that's created by a government entity. Now, in this case, there has been a real pushback from the citizen. There's been lots of people who've created other science trying to show that the government approach.
Yeah, but unfortunately, Joe, what I think really happened there is, you know, to create confusion, you have agency, you know, like the Central Entertainment Agency, helping to create dozens of 9/11 videos, et cetera, to confuse and mislead people that don't have the trivium to reverse engineer all of their fallacious BS.
Couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. There's lots of agents, but, you know, at least we're forcing them to take that step. And the citizen, I think, in general, is waking up to the fact that he can't trust the mainstream media, which has to be the first step. No one's ever going to believe anything that the three of us say who believes the information that comes from the mainstream media.
Yeah, you know, it's getting into people's minds. Hey, look, you know, study the trivium, study the logical fallacies, learn what they are, learn to trust your own five senses, to check our citations, and simply look at what we're doing by reverse engineering all of their fallacious rhetoric, and then you can come to know the truth yourself. And this is what has been conditioned out of people through the compulsory education system.
Well, I think this is part of the frightening thing, is realizing how pervasive this material is and how little alternative there really is out there, in terms of that, the Disney studios are now questioning, well, what about Hanna-Barbera? When we look into them, are we going to find the same thing? Oh, probably. You know, we've been doing an analysis of Jupiter Ascending and the Wachowski brothers, and trying to find out, well, you know, to what extent are they complicit in all of this? And you can make a case that maybe they're trying to convey a different message, but then again, maybe they're also part of the same system. And how can we even cleanse our own brains of all of this stuff that we've been fed? It's a real challenge. And I think that Joe is right that, you have got to start from where you are and move from there.
Exactly right. Yesterday I was sent a link to the movie The Hunger Games, and the person was pointing out that the character Titus was a cannibal under these very bizarre circumstances, and the only character in the film was that was a cannibal was this Titus individual. And I haven't seen the movie, don't know anything about the producers, but I responded that I would be willing to bet, 5-1, that this wasn't circumstance, and that that the association with Titus to cannibalism was in fact deliberate, and it was done by someone who understood the gospel's typology. You see, this is one of the...
Well, that's a leap, Joe, because Titus Andronicus is something of affiliated with cannibalism in the Shakespeare, so it might
right,
not go any further back than that.
I know, and it's I just think that the Shakespearean influence in the Hunger Games is limited, and that I would say at least it's suspicious that the character would be associated with cannibalism. And, you know, the thing
is, it would be worth a look.
Pardon me?
It sure would be worth a look.
Yeah, it's worth a look. And I think that the point is that when we start to do analysis of things like Sergeant Pepper's and I Am the Walrus and now Catcher in the Rye, we're starting to build a context. And the context, at a certain point, when enough data has been brought forward and enough of the media and the literature and the films have been completely demonstrated to be representing this oligarchic vision through symbolism, then I think that we'll be able to look at things like the Hunger Games and have a real strong suspicion. And if nothing else, one thing I would really like to do is I would like to stop the oligarchs from using this vicious genocidal typology. I mean, they're, you know, this goes back to the Caesars, and then into from there, you know, into the group that surrounded Shakespeare or this woman, Emilia Bassano. And I mean, it is not a beneficial humor. It's really murderous. And so I would like it to stop because I don't think it has a good influence on people. I think that the Romans were engaging in mind control when they were suggesting that all of the Jewish rebels killed themselves at the end of the Jewish war, that this was the best way to worship God was by suicide. And I also think that the author of the Hamlet was, you know, basically reversing that grim and murderous mind control type humor with the Gentile destruction at the end of that play. And I just think that exposing it is a useful thing because it's a sick humor. It's very, very ill. And I don't think people should be engaging it. And if they do and the public starts calling them on it, we can put an end to it pretty quickly. And I think the public then would have a better understanding of their media. They'd understand that the media had been used as a weapon, going back to the Life magazine cover and the story about Gordon Wasson. That story, the story that Wasson published, every word of it was a lie. It was all done to create propaganda that would make taking drugs later on more acceptable. And the disgusting phrase that they included teenage allowances with the description of the article, I mean, whoever wrote that is a sick person. I mean, this is a psychopath because you're using sophisticated intellectual tools basically to bring about mental illness on the part of the public. So, you know, you can see that now when you come to Salinger and realize that he's part of this, that he knows about this, that he is accepting it. And, you know, he was a recluse. I don't know to what extent he's involved in anything once he comes back from the war. But I know he could have been a whistleblower, and instead he chose to be in the organization and to write a piece of literature that basically represents their symbolism, this sick, apocalyptic kind of symbolism. That
it represents capitulation to it. Exactly.
Yeah, and also, let me look, it gives the people that want to send a message to others to keep their mouth shut, to keep the secrets. It gives them a tool to do so with.
Indeed it does. So did you want to read some of your analysis, Joe, from your Catcher thing?
Well, I can do, but unfortunately it's kind of a building block. And so I can read, let me just read the...
You know, maybe we should talk about James Castle. What do you think?
Oh, gee whiz. James Castle, the representation of Jesus Christ. He's silent before he's killed. He won't tell the people what he wants. And basically, James Castle is a reversing of the story in the Gospels where the Romans killed Jesus Christ. In this story, the Freemasons kill a symbolic representation of the Roman Jesus.
Well, so how can you tell, Joe, whether it's the Roman Jesus or whether it's the historical Jesus? I mean, what are the clues that would let you play or the other?
Right.
I mean, he seems to be kind of just an innocent fellow. He's described as pimply and awkward, and he seems to be standing up for something that he believes in somehow, and the conceited fella comes in and beats him up and six of his buddies, and they wind up throwing him out the window. Kind of sounds like the death of an innocent.
Right. The way that I'm able to understand it is that, you know, you have the genealogy that Caulfield is emerging from, and here you have to get into a little bit of, you know, because Caulfield, the word is from the Caulf, which is basically a designation of a unique individual. It occurs once in every 80,000 children. They have a kind of veil over their face when they're born, and so it's part of how Caulfield is represented as a messianic individual. He's also said to have white hair and have a towering height. So he's, you know, these are aspects that kind of stand him out. And with James Castle, they create a genealogy that I think is kind of witty, but you'd have to be kind of deeply into gospel humor to get it. Caulfield said that he remembered Castle because he was the person in the roll call who came directly before him. And he said that it would be Cabell, Castle, Caulfield. And this is playing off of, particularly in the context in the book of the genealogy in the Gospels, by which the Romans put a fake Jesus into motion that was a Roman Christ, basically. And the two cabals, cabal, I mean, I think that's completely deliberate. That's referencing the two cabals, the Roman cabal and the cabal that is the Freemasons. Jerry's interpretation is plausible. And in fact, because the people who do the killing are called conceited, you can make some sense out of it. But you know, I would just go back to the acceptance of the real version or the body version of Catcher in the Rye as the right kind of framework to understand these things from. And so I don't think that Salinger is setting up some kind of, you know, pleasant description of a Jew being killed. No, I don't think that's what is going on here.
Well, there was another piece of typology that you mentioned, which was linking to the fella that the stonecutters, the lunatic stonecutter. And what you showed in Caesar's Messiah was that lunatic stonecutter was a representation, again, of the real Jewish rebels.
Right.
And Caulfield remarks that he likes those guys. Those are his favorites.
Right.
Much less so than the 12 apostles that would represent the Roman apostles.
Right. Yeah, he likes the lunatic, yeah.
He likes the lunatic, and he links himself to James Castle both by that genealogy that you mentioned and by sharing his sweater with James Castle. And then it's mentioned later on that Antolini was the man that helped carry the body of James Castle, that wanted to check and make sure he was dead, maybe taken to the hospital. So there's that.
Right. Right. It's interesting. The way that the lunatic is described indicates that Caulfield knows about the group that battled against the Roman, the Messianic movement. Now, what's interesting is that group had a designation of the Sons of Light, and that the lunatic in the Gospels is characterized as cutting himself with stones, and the event that he goes through typologically looks at the end of the war when the same people are with stone cutters. You see, it's a little wordplay, cutting themselves with stone and stone cutters. And that word, the Greek word is tekton, which means stonemason, and is actually used to designate Freemasons in Greece. And so the person that that Caulfield is liking would have been the militaristic Jewish Sons of Light. That would be the group that the lunatic who cut himself with stones came from. So there's a pretty clear foundation piece as to the perspective that Salinger has as to who is good. I mean, he's looking at Roman Catholicism as being the problem, and that the original group that fought against them being heroic.
Yeah, but then in the end, Caulfield himself does not get killed. He's under threat from Antolini that the same thing's going to happen to him as happened to James Castle. All through the book, Caulfield is constantly worrying that he's going to get killed.
Right.
But in the end, he decides to make peace with his father and stay with his sister, and he goes and gets rehabilitated. And so he's given up on that youthful rebellion and joined the conspiracy. He's
right.
Sold out.
Well, yeah, I mean, he grew up according to the standards that the Freemasons are holding out for him. You know, he learned that you have to live humbly for the cause.
Yep, instead of dying for something that you believe in that's not right. Such a great thing.
Right, yeah. So you can see there's
James Castle is someone who died for not such a great thing.
Right, and that's why I see him as more representing the Gospels Roman Christ than a real Jewish Christ, because he does the wrong thing, and
Maybe the secret is there's no such thing as the real Jewish Christ, in the sense that there was the rebel Christ who was militaristic, which we might not appreciate any more than the Roman Christ that's fake.
Interesting idea. The fact is that Salinger is making a genealogy up in that passage, just to spoof and to play off of the genealogy that's given in the Gospels. So what actually it all means, I use Antolini's name. His name means different line. And so, you can, at least in my mind, you can interpret it as the different line than the one that's being replaced. Antolini could be relating back to a Jewish Messiah, or he could be relating to a lineage of Messianic individuals that is somehow kept secret by the Freemasons. I mean, at a certain point, you just don't have enough data from the symbolism to really have specific understanding. It'll be interesting to see if this analysis becomes widely understood, what Freemasons will do about it, particularly those at the higher levels who can fill in all of the gaps that you can't do with just decoding the symbolism.
Yeah, now there are a lot of gaps in this analysis, in the sense that if you read Catcher in the Rye with the eye to the notion that, well, it's a lot of typology and a lot of symbolism, you've decoded maybe 30 or 40% of it. There's a lot left.
For sure, absolutely. And in fact, there'll be other articles that we'll come up with to try to work with the book and try to take the revelations a little bit further. But my hope is that there is a foundation now, a very clear foundation. And this is the important thing, is that, look, we will argue about points, and there'll be other points we can't even possibly understand that are being made in the book. But we can be certain that there is a very sinister trajectory of symbolism that the public was not aware of, and that is related to the same trajectory in other works of art, in other media, and other events. And so the purpose here is to try to get people thinking, getting them concerned, getting them working to decode this, and getting people who have little pieces of the puzzle to come forward and to assist the analysis. I would bet it would be impossible for a person to decode Catcher in the Rye down to the last word. There isn't enough data out there to do it. But there are people who are living today who know every single aspect of its meaning. And that's what would be great to have happen, is to have that process started and to have inside of Freemasonry people inside of the government that are familiar with what these books mean to start coming forward, start helping the citizen break free of all of this treachery. And if that doesn't happen, then at the very least to have the citizens become more energized and to start doing their own analysis. Because I think if enough people are working on Catcher in the Rye, you're going to have a dramatic change in how people relate to their culture, their media, and also to their government. Remember, Salinger is OSS. He's not just an author from, you know, Beatnikville. He is deep inside military intelligence at the same time that MKUltra is being developed, or the technologies that led up to MKUltra being developed. In fact, and just to show you how connected this all is, in the next article I'll put out, I'm going to cover Salinger's description of the dorm that he lived in, Ossenberg Hall, because it's definitely related to the Ossenberg List, which is the list that describes the bringing of the German scientists to the United States under Operation Paperclip, which then becomes MKUltra. Paperclip brought rocket scientists that are very well known, but it also brought psychological scientists who had been doing treacherous research during World War II. These people were brought into the United States, and much of the science ends up with MKUltra. And so, Salinger's mention of it is very, very worrisome, and it suggests that we really need to start, you know, learning about how to decode what they are leaving for us as representations of their plan.
Yeah, now I hope that people will come to visit our website and go to the forum and participate in this search for what all this means. It's not a small project. You know, when you think about it, there's probably been millions of term papers written on the topic of this book, Catcher in the Rye. People have been thinking about these mysteries for a long time. Now, there will be a certain amount of compare and contrast going on of some of the ideas that are out there now in the Spark Notes and whatnot about what these things mean versus what you've detected. Does your thing make sense? Does the Spark Notes version have anything to contribute? And do any of those millions of term papers have anything to add?
Right.
And then we can go and search the internet for some of these names and concepts and see if any of them turn up. You know, decoding typology is a lot of fun once you get into it.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, I would hope that it becomes a nationwide passion, because this is what we need to do in order to learn the language of the oligarchs so that we can defend ourselves against plans that are selfish, murderous from time to time, perhaps even apocalyptic, and at the very least are completely outside the control of democracy. I mean, at this point, we're voting for people we don't even know what kind of oath they're taking. Hillary Clinton,
Joe,
and Jeb Bush.
Joe, just so you know, my last episode with Freeman Burt exposes the whole oath thing, so I do recommend listeners get an understanding of that as well.
Yeah, thank you. The oath-taking at Skull and Bone, what are the oaths? When Tim Russert asked Kerry and Bush during the presidential race that they were running, what were the oaths that they had sworn? They wouldn't tell them. Both of them are members of Skull and Bone.
Well, so he did end up dead later right after that. So then,
exactly right.
You know, it's all good,
under
right?
Odd circumstances. So this is not this isn't democracy at a high level. Now we've got Clinton, who was a Demolé, which is a youth version of the Freemasons member. His wife is running against Jeb Bush, evidently, that they're the two front runners. Jeb being, George Bush Jr., Skull and Bones member's brother. And of course, their father, the senior George Bush, was a Skull and Bone member. So we need to decode typology so that we can have an understanding of what kind of oath and what kind of perspective of humanity that these people have. Because when I look around, I just see so much catastrophe, and so much of it is related to this political class. Because whoever they are, they have made a science of gaining political control and financial control. And so it's as if we have a world of authority, a financial authority, a military authority, a political authority. This world above us, we can't even understand the motivations. They won't. Nothing is told to us about the workings of it. Our democracy.
We can read Aldous Huxley's work and get a pretty good picture.
And then you can see the plan is genocide and the dumbing down of the population, the addiction of them to drugs. It's the apocalypse. So. In slow motion. So anyway, it's time the citizens organize themselves and try to create a higher level of democracy. And I do believe, honestly, that people who read the article will get some energy to try to make more sense of the literature and the movies and the songs, all of the things that contribute to what we call culture.
Indeed. Anything for you to add, Jerry?
Well, another fascinating thing about decoding typology is that I've noticed there is another group besides us that's very interested in it, and it's the fundamentalist Christians are fascinated with this. There are websites like Vigilant Christian or Vigilant Citizen.
DebunkJoeAtwill.com.
There might be that too, but they view it as a battle between Christ and Lucifer, and they are actually worried that the source of all of this typological literature is coming straight from the devil. And I have a friend locally that I talk to about this, and I say, well, you know, fundamentalist Christianity is just another manifestation of the same thing, as Joe has shown in Caesar's Messiah. That the oligarchs created this Christian religion that they're following, and that also that ironically enough, Lucifer is really just another name for Jesus Christ. So the battle that they see is the same entity battling itself, and trying to get through to that whole school of thought, I think, is a fascinating challenge.
Yeah, that's a tough nut, but you're absolutely right, and it's an example of how confused people are. Is that they don't really know who they're fighting because they've been arranged in such a way that their minds detect, what could be the benefit to them as their enemy. You know, they just don't. They don't really know up from down. Once you've been, you know, these fundamental groups are so confused that it's very, very hard for them to look at literature in a, you know, with a clear mind. I would suspect that the real rebellion will occur from young professionals who have access to social media. I think the internet is the power that can generate the movement, the ability to have the movement. And I think the young professionals who are used to working with it and can exchange information very quickly, and by and large are fairly clear-minded. Many of them are in technical businesses. Many of them are highly educated. I think that's where the response is going to come. I think that I was listening to NPR yesterday and was astounded that it was playing a section from a new film about the Pentagon 911. I don't know if you saw that, Jerry, but it was a very clear-minded and real description of all of the things that led up to and occurred during the Pentagon attack on 9/11, and it was taking the position that it was an inside job. And this was on public radio, and it was presenting very, I thought, strong evidence for that case. Now that's
well, that's a major breakdown of a gatekeeper wall, because NPR for a long time has been absolutely dead set against any kind of conspiracy analysis of 9/11.
Yep, I was amazed, and there it was. So the internet, I believe, is having an influence. Mainstream media is losing followers every day. People are creating their own system of gaining information and doing analysis, sharing it. You know, there is hope. We're not at what I would regard a feudal system level yet, where they have us completely pinned to the mat. We can organize ourselves and try to create a better democracy.
Yeah, I think the internet is just a fantastic research tool, for one thing, just for gaining this kind of understanding. It's such an amazing search tool for finding what's been said, and also an amazing tool for linking people together.
You know, exactly. I mean, just an example, when I started to do the catcher, there was no way I could have ever had done this analysis if I was just had the book and a curiosity. I mean, because I had the internet, I was able to scan through Freemason initiation rites, J.D. Salinger's life. I mean, there was just information available at my fingertips that would have taken months of work if all I had was a library.
We've forgotten the days when you had to go down to the library and bring a stack of books out, bring them home, and page through them by hand, try to find some relevant information.
And that's just the thing with Gordon Wasson and Aldous Huxley and all of these clowns in the circus at the CIA. You know, in the 1950s and 60s, they couldn't foresee this internet and this tool with everybody putting their own data on their computers and then linking it to every other computer in the world so that we could all access that type of information. But, you know, so now you can access books and archives and academic journals and all of this stuff right at your fingertips, and also other people's analyses on other websites. And, you know, and you'll be researching along and you'll type in, you know, Aldous Huxley and this, and there'll be like one or two other people on a forum or a blog somewhere who've discussed this same stuff, you know.
There are thousands and thousands of people. And you know something? In my opinion, I can see such a strong trajectory toward sunlight that is occurring vis-a-vis the power of the internet, that if it is permitted to go forward for another 10 or 20 years, I just think it'll wipe the oligarchs' control out. So,
well, that's, you know, that's why Obama was up in San Francisco a few weeks ago doing the cyber security, quote unquote, thing. And then, of course, the next day or 2 days later, you have this what appears to be a false flag hack on the British banks and the stealing of £250 million over there. But, you know, I think that's what really the cybersecurity summit was all about, and trying to put in a Chinese style system of control on the internet across the world, because they know that the internet is a major threat to their, you know, to the Central Entertainment Agency's control.
Of course. My daughter was in China a few years ago, and she said that they had a lot of ways of monitoring and preventing people from using different parts of the internet. But she said that, in fact, the people could do workarounds faster than the government could create blockage. She said that they literally had hundreds of different ways and systems set up in order to circumvent it.
You know, I was a network engineer for years, Joe, and during the war against Yugoslavia, I lived over there, and they would shut down Yugoslavia, Serbia's internet, and it would take them an hour or two to reroute the entire country's internet through another path.
Right. So it's going to be hard to control. It's actually, I mean, Jerry would actually...
Well, I think it's about as hard to control as the printing press was.
Yeah.
The printing press was the last major change.
And for people who are interested, I have done a few episodes with Christoph Atlas on cybersecurity and encryption and using Tails Linux and how to keep yourself safe online using darknets, etc.
Yeah. So it's going to be tough for them to control. And There is right now, anyway, a tool in existence. So I would just hope everyone that is troubled or inspired or even thinks that just the analysis in the article is plausible will take that as an energizing event and use the internet to spread the information, get people to set up their own sites, attend postflaviana.org, participate in it, bring your information to us, you know, support and participate in Gnostic Media, because Jan has been literally a pathfinder, you know, through the wilderness here, and deserves all the support anyone can give to him. And so,
and I might as well just spill the beans now. So I've got an operation coming up in 2 weeks that has to be done. It's a inguinal hernia operation. That's going to cost me about $4,300 in cash. So we really appreciate everyone's donations and support, because that's how I have to pay for this crap.
Well, that is, you know, that is something that really should be dealt with, and I hope people pay attention to that, because, you know, we really deserve to be supported, and so let's you know, do what we can.
Please donate, folks. I got to come up with $9,000-$10,000, you know, and I did get about $1,500 worth of donations asking over the last couple of weeks, but we really have quite a gap to fill in there. So everyone, please, your help is greatly appreciated. And of course, I will be out for at least a week or two after the surgery date.
Good luck with the surgery, Jan.
Woohoo. Yeah, joy. I'm really looking forward to it. I haven't seen the inside of a hospital since I left Peru and got over that 15-year fiasco of stomach problems and incompetent U.S. doctors.
Right. Well, the medical system is unfortunately another of the problems that we have. And there's just so many things to fix. We'll find a way. We'll get it all done. But anyway, you know, just want to wrap it up. You know, thanks for listening. Please come to our site, read the article, share the article. The article is for the public.
Make sure you send me the link for the article over there.
Yeah, I'll send you the link for the article. And let's start to understand the system that is
You cut out, Joe. The system that is what? I just lost you. Joe, you there? Hello?
I think he was probably going to say the system arrayed against us.
Yeah. Well, we just lost Joe right at the end there. So, yep.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Jan, for having us both on.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's a wrap.
Okay.
Right on Joe's last sentence. All right, Jerry, and have a good day, and we'll follow up again soon. And make sure I get the link and whatever citations I need to post for the show notes here.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so much, and thanks to everybody for listening. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.